Okay, welcome. This is Friday, June 2nd, 2006. This is a retreat of the Pacifica National Board. Our formal board meeting will be beginning tonight at 6:30 p.m. But during this public session of the retreat, I'm very honored to have with us a couple of guests. The first one is Dr. Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. Prior to joining the faculty there, he was Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and a professor at the University of Chicago. He represented the website operator Eric Eldred in the groundbreaking case Eldred versus Ashcroft, a challenge to the 1998 Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. He's won numerous awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, and was named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries for arguing against interpretations of copyright that could stifle innovation and discourse online. He's the author of Free Culture, The Future of Ideas, and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, and he chairs the Creative Commons Project and serves on the board of the Free Software Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Public Library of Science, and Public Knowledge. And he's agreed to come and speak to the Pacifica Board about issues of licensing content as more and more audio content becomes available for digital distribution through a variety of channels. Questions regarding licensing are really critical in determining how that content reaches out, reaches people, is used by people, persists, and all the rest. We have critical questions before us about what economic models we're going to use for generating revenue in that new world, what our ethics are, and the rest of it. And Dr. Lessig has agreed to come in, talk to us about various licensing approaches, and has expressed a willingness to work with the board to design licenses that are ideally suited to our situation and ethics as part of a larger effort to expand civic media. So without any further and just so you know the structure of this, I'd ask Dr. Lessig to present to us for about 40 minutes. It's a little less than that. And then also we've invited Ken Friedman, who's the general manager of WFMU, their building situated over in Jersey City. And they're sort of the pioneer in the community radio movement on making programming available through digital distribution and on the web. And if I understand correctly, that station, community radio station, generates approximately 50% of its revenues from online distribution of audio content. So Ken's going to give us a brief presentation about their experience. We also have a quick 10-minute presentation on Virtual Program Director, an interface for aggregating our own content. And then I think we'll have about an hour for discussion of the various issues. So without any further ado, hold on a second. Are we okay on the stream, guys?
Yes.
We're fine? Okay. In that case, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Lessig. This is his presentation, and we're going to clear out so that everybody can see the screen behind us.
So thank you very much, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you. I'm going to actually do a lot of presentations there.
Okay, great.
I'm especially grateful because this issue of what David framed to me of civic media is an issue which is extremely important to the nonprofit that I run, a nonprofit called Creative Commons. And this was important opportunity for us to begin to think about how civic media as an idea could interact with maybe the most important aspect of civic media we have in American culture right now, which is public stations and public radio. So let me start with an idea of a definition of what I think of as civic media. So civic media, in the sense I want to talk about it, is media which is universal, meaning it ought to be everywhere, and democratic, meaning anybody can use it. So in this sense, the classic bit of civic media that we know is text or writing, which is universal in the sense that we aspire that everybody's able to do it, to write, and democratic in the sense that the technologies of writing are such that basically anybody can afford to do it. And what's interesting is that in some periods of American history, at least, everybody could even publish because of the costs of access to publishing technologies. So, for example, at the time of the founding, printing was actually extremely cheap and universal in the United States. In constant 1970 dollars, 1790, it cost about $10,000 to set up a printing press. And that's what, of course, led to the extraordinary explosion of the pamphleteer press, which was extremely important in defining what the revolution would be, and defining that the revolution would be a revolution of ideas, as people debated ideas in print, and a wide range of people had access to that opportunity to debate ideas in print. Over time, this access to media was taken away because the cost of printing went up so dramatically. So in the same dollars, by 1860, the cost of setting up a printing establishment was about $2.5 million, meaning the influence of speech like this slowly disappeared. So that's the sense in which I mean this opportunity for people to use text in this democratic way to communicate to others who expected to be able to engage in the same kind of expression. Now, in that kind of expression, there's a kind of creative activity. And the creative activity that we recognize just on the second's reflection is that the act is building upon the work of others. So there's a freedom that we take for granted, that when we write in this traditional sense using text, we can take and use other people's work in that writing as long as we do two things. One, we quote, meaning we cite them. And second, that we don't use too much in the process of using their other work. So creative writing in my high school was something like this. You basically took the works of Ernest Hemingway or the works of Fitzgerald, and you were told to write a creative writing essay, and that was basically mixing the two together in a way that said something creative about what you had learned from these two kinds of texts. Okay. Now, what would civic media in a digital age look like? Well, here too, I think it's universal and democratic. So what would that be? Well, the fact is we're seeing that much wider range of media now qualifies as civic media. A wide range of media has been democratized by digital technologies. So video and music and graphics are now as accessible as the pencil and the typewriter were to the generation that you and I knew growing up, right? So the point is, the technology has expanded the range of media that is available for civic media, democratized in this sense. And companies, like these companies, are building their whole business on the idea that they will encourage people to engage in what we can think of in the sense of being an aspect of civic media, to consume and to create and share their creativity using tools of digital technology. Now, there are a lot of examples of this. You're familiar with all of them. I just want to put them all on the table so we have a common point of reference. Blogs are the most familiar in this space. Techtorati, the indexing source for blogs, this morning reports 42.2 million blogs out there in the world. Podcasts becoming an increasingly important way in which the civic media happens. Here's Apple's podcasting site, which allows you to go through literally thousands of podcasts and subscribe to the ones that you would want. These forms of expression are changing the use of digital media as it is relevant to important public activities. So most important that blogs typically deal with is the activity of reporting. Not all of them, but a significant number of them engage in an act which is similar to, different from, but similar to the acts of reporting. And increasingly, digital media becomes a tool for reporting in a wider range ideas people have about their own life and experience in the world. My favorite is 2004. This film, Tarnation, makes a debut at Cannes. BBC says that it Wow's Cannes. This is a film that's made for $218. This kid took video that he had shot through his whole life using an iMac given to him by his friend. He remixed it of a quality to wow Cannes and to win the 2004 Los Angeles International Film Festival. So one part of the way these digital media get used is a way of just expressing and reporting facts around the world. A very distinct part is the way in which digital media gets used to remix culture around us. I'm going to give you some examples, a lot of them just because they're fun, not so much relevant, but some fun. There's this explosion of something called anime music video out there. So you know what anime are? These are the Japanese cartoons. Anime music videos where kids basically take these cartoons and they re-edit them to set them to a music track. Let me give you two quick samples of this.
I don't need another turn to cry. No, I don't want to learn the hard way. Baby, hello, oh no, goodbye. But you got me like a rocket, shooting straight across the sky.
Here's another one, a little more familiar. A kind of remixing of culture, right? And it's not just AMVs that are doing this. In the area of music, we've seen a lot of this activity. You know this album by the Beatles called The White Album, which inspired this album by Jay-Z called The Black Album, which then inspired this album by DJ Danger Mouse called The Gray Album, which literally synthesizes the tracks of The White Album and Black Album together to produce something great. And then there's an increasing effort to report by remixing. So mixing together this idea of using digital technologies to report by using this technique of remixing. And politics has been the most important example of that. I'm going to give you three clips.
Do you ever get the feeling you are living in a virtual reality dream world? Fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of American Juniors.
Shake, shake, shake your body!
But there is another sound, the sound of goodwill.
Oh, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things secondhand.
But this one's a little simpler to make.
So to answer your question, I just know how this world works. I see on the TV screens how hard it is. We're making progress. It is hard work. You know, it's hard work. It's hard work. A lot of really good people working hard, they can do the hard work. That's what distinguishes us from the enemy. And it's hard work, but it's necessary work, and that's essential. But again, I want to tell the American people, it's hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work. There was no doubt in my mind that's necessary work. I understand how hard it is. That's my job. No doubt about it. It's tough. It's hard work, which I really want to do, but I would hope I'd never have to. Nothing wrong with that. But again, I repeat to my fellow citizens, we're making progress. We're making progress there. I reject this notion. It's ludicrous. It is hard work. It's hard work. That's the plan for victory, and that is the best way. What I said was, it's hard work, and made that very clear.
And this is my very favorite.
My love, there's only you in my life. The only thing that's bright.
My first You're every breath that I take. You're every step I make.
And I want to share all my love with you. No one else.
So they say most of the stuff on the internet is crap, and most of it is, but some of it is extraordinarily talented, right? And extraordinarily talented as people use these digital technologies to find different, more powerful ways to speak. And just think about those political messages. They are, of course, in one sense, just remixes of media, but they have in their architecture the most powerful political message that you could deliver in this culture, because as much as those of us who write and teach texts would love to believe, as most of us, those of us who live life writing books would love to believe, most of the world does not get its knowledge from words. Most of the world doesn't understand arguments from words. Most don't spend their time understanding different points of view by reading books. Most increasingly get their exposure to ideas through this form of media, through a wide range of media that tries to capture and compel ideas in the way it's crafted. And this is becoming an increasingly common way, especially the way our kids use expression. This is the way they speak. Pew did a study finding 57% of teenagers had produced and shared content on the internet. That's not down peer-to-peer file sharing, that number is about 99%. But this is people who are actually creating their own content and sharing their content with others using digital technology. And so it becomes increasingly important as we have a kind of parallel reality culture being developed in parallel to the kind of professional culture that's being developed, like reality TV in parallel to professional TV, reality culture, as people increasingly use this media to create and define the culture that they live in. And it increasingly becomes a kind of literacy, the capacity for kids to use these technologies to speak, the mixture of music and images, the mixture of music and graphics, the mixture of video, becomes a way for them to speak. It's how they will use these tools as they increasingly discover the power of these tools to express ideas. It's a literacy for the 21st century. Now, if you think about this idea of civic media for the digital age, there's some obvious problems which we lawyers bring to the project. Right? And the core problem is that this writing for the digital age, this kind of literacy, is under the laws of copyright now presumptively illegal. The norms that we take for granted in the ordinary context of writing for text, which are clear, these norms that say you can take and quote and use and reuse without ever worrying about clearing permission first, those norms don't exist in the context of media, or at least to the extent they do exist, they're extraordinarily unclear. Complicated system of permissions around the ability to use and to reuse media, and very strong norms within the media industry against granting permission. So these AMV sites are increasingly getting notice and takedowns from lawyers telling them that their creativity is not to be allowed. DJ Danger Mouse knew that the Beatles never give permission to remix their work in any form at all. BBC, after this kid discovered he could wow Khan for $218, he then discovered it would cost $400,000 to clear the rights to the music and the background of the video that he had shot growing up. And here's my favorite example of how weird we lawyers can be. I don't care what you think about Tony Blair and George Bush, though I guess I think I have a pretty clear idea of what that might be, but still, I don't care what you think about them or the war. The one thing you can't say about this clip is what the lawyers said when they denied permission to synchronize the Lionel Richie music with those images. They said, no, you cannot have our permission because, quote, it's not funny, end quote. So the point is, we have this practice in the industry and this rule of law that requires permission, and this rule increasingly shadows the opportunity for people to use these digital technologies to produce and share speech. It produces an illegality around these activities, which limit the opportunity for it to spread, certainly limits the opportunity to commercialize a lot of this creativity, and drives a significant set of these creative acts underground. So what would a set of solutions be for this problem created by the interaction between these new forms of expression and old practices of law? Well, the obvious one would be to think about legal reform, but the reality is that's not happening anytime soon, and the reason it's not happening anytime soon is that in America, at least, we have a kind of IP McCarthyism that governs debates about intellectual property. If you question the particular ways in which intellectual property function today, you are referred to, as I've been referred to many times, as a, quote, communist. So the only view that's available in Washington about these issues is that you're either for intellectual property or against it. Any attempt to try to get people to think critically about how far it's gone or whether it's gone too far for the media is just rejected. So in my view, at least right now, there's no real opportunity for effective, meaningful legal reform in this context. And that's made urgent projects that I've been involved with that you can think of as a kind of private reform effort. And the core one that's been taking up my life in the last 4 years has been this project called Creative Commons. So the aim of Creative Commons is to find a simple way for authors to mark their content with the freedoms that they intend their content to carry. The critical idea here is that authors are taking the step to mark the content. It's not users who make that choice for the authors. So this is an effort to move us from the kind of all rights reserved world that we live in right now to a some rights reserved world. So the author reserves some rights to himself and gives others to the public at large. So you select these freedoms by going to our site and selecting a license. The license asks you to answer three simple questions. Do you want to allow commercial use of your work? Do you want to allow modifications of your work? And if you allow modifications, do you want to require that others release their work in a similarly free way? This is a kind of copyleft idea that would force the content that was made as a derivative to be released under a similar share-alike license. Once you've made that selection, you're given a license. The license comes in three separate layers. First layer is a commons deed, a human readable expression of the freedoms associated with your content, intended to be understandable by anybody as they try to understand what they're allowed to do with content. Second, and very different, is a lawyer-readable license, right? A billion-page document written by the best lawyers that we can find to make legally enforceable the freedoms associated with the content so that organizations and individuals can rely upon those freedoms. And third, and extremely important, is a machine-readable expression of the freedoms associated with the content so that search engines can begin to gather content on the basis of the freedoms. So last year, Yahoo and Google both opened a portal up in their web searches so that you could search the web and filter the results on Creative Commons licenses. So you can say, show me all the pictures available for non-commercial use of the Empire State Building, and you get content gathered for you, filtered according to those freedoms. Now, we launched this project originally in the United States, but the most important extension was to expand its work internationally. So we expanded it by basically taking these three layers and extending the legal code layer, so porting the licenses from one jurisdiction into another, so that the commons deed would be translated into local languages, but the licenses would be actually ported to different jurisdictions, and the digital code, or the machine-readable expression of the freedoms, is universal across all jurisdictions. Now there are more than 70 countries in the process of porting the licenses. This is a map of the free world as it exists today. The green countries have launched Creative Commons licenses. The yellow countries will launch in the next 6 months, and the red countries are yet to be liberated in this process. And as we've expanded this internationally, we've seen an explosion in the uptake of the licenses. So in the first year, we recorded about 1 million link backs to our licenses. At a year and a half, that number is at about 1.8 million, meaning 1.8 million places on the web where people are using our licenses to release their content. At 2 years, the number was at about 4 million. At 2.5 years, the number is at about 12 million. At 3 years, which was last December, the number is at about 44 million. And in June, today, is the first time we're making this data available, the number is now over about 110 million link backs to our licenses. So there's an increasing growth rate as this project extends internationally of people marking more and more content with these types of freedoms. So let's get a sense of practical sense of how this functions. This is a guitar track, if you can hear it. Written by an activist and guitarist, Colin Mutchler, titled My Life, released on an online sound resource licensed under a Creative Commons license. The sound resource was OpSound. It was downloaded by a 17-year-old violinist named Cora Beth, and she added this violin track you should hear on top. And then she renamed the song, My Life Changed, and re-released it back to the internet for other people to remix. And we found at least 7 remixes of this song, some really fantastic, some a little embarrassing. There's a Japanese remix, My Life Changed Absolutely, which we don't show very much. But the part that my colleagues find hard to understand is that here these two creators, who had never met each other, never spoke to each other, were able to create legally, recreate legally, without any lawyer standing between them. And that's the objective of the Creative Commons project, to allow people to respect the underlying intellectual property, to build a system where it's simple for them to respect the underlying intellectual property, but to encourage a kind of legal creativity without requiring the typical burdens of that legality, which is to engage lawyers in the process of facilitating that creativity. Now, many people look at this and they say, well, why would a creator ever want to make his or her work available in this way? There are 2 very different reasons I want to identify. First is, it might actually help the creator. So, for example, many of you, I'm sure, know this fantastic band called Wilco. Their album, my favorite of their albums, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, was hated by their record label. So their record label told them they wouldn't release the album. And Wilco said, well, we're not going to change it, so why don't you just give it back to us? So Wilco was given the album and the rights back by the record label, and then they released the album on the internet for free under terms that are basically the same as our non-commercial license. That led to an extraordinary spread of this album across the internet. And the buzz around the album then inspired another record label to buy the rights back for 3 times the price the original record label paid. And then they sold the record in the traditional way through CD. And the sales of this record relative to every other Wilco record far exceeded anything Wilco had ever done before. So the point was, this was a method, a way to increase their objective, the bottom line objective here, of selling more CDs. Or in other contexts, for example, there's a South African research council called the Human Sciences Research Council. They have about 250 researchers and 12 different research programs. For most of their history, their business method was to sell books. They would produce research books and sell them. 2001, they decided to stop doing that and instead give away all of their work free on the web, but then to offer an optional print-on-demand service. So you could get everything you wanted for free, but if you wanted a printed version, you did a print-on-demand service, they would send it to you. After 3 years, they did an evaluation of the effect on sales, right? Before, everything was sold. Now, sales were an optional, and everything was given away for free. And the result was that the sales of this department went up by 300% in those 3 years. For the obvious reason that by making it accessible, more people learned about the work, and a significant number of those people, like most of us, would prefer to actually read a report in paper rather than on a computer screen. So this was a technique, making it available in this way, to actually increase the number of research reports that were used and sales of those research reports. So those are examples of why you might use it, because it would actually help the business model that you have, recognizing there are many different business models for creators. Some are like Madonna's, where they try to control and get money for every single use of the creative work. Many others are like academics, where the objective is to spread the ideas as far as you possibly can. But a second set of reasons basically have to do with the ethic of the particular kind of creator. Because for this type of creator, releasing their work in this way is just right. And this is the objective of a sister project we have called the Science Commons Project, which actually works with science because of a common ethic among scientists, an ethic that recognizes their obligation, which is not just to create knowledge, but to create universal access to knowledge. So it's not enough for a scientist to produce a great new idea and then publish it in a journal that costs universities $25,000 a year to subscribe to, recognizing that that means just a handful of American universities will get access to this as opposed to researchers around the world. This obligation or ethic of scientists is to make their work accessible in a way that people around the world, regardless of income, can get access to it. And building upon that ethic, the Science Commons movement helps more and more researchers and academics make their work available in a way that guarantees this type of access. So MIT has put all of their online course material available under Creative Commons license to guarantee people around the world the opportunity to extend it. Rice has a project that makes course teaching material available in this way. And the most important new journal, set of journals, Public Library of Science, makes all of their journal articles available free on the web under a Creative Commons license while printing traditional journals that people buy in the old-fashioned way. Now, in each of these cases, the objective of the license is both to enable this access and also to remind scientists of the values that define their activity. Those values are values of guaranteeing access as much as discovering knowledge. Now, as we've launched this project, we've built tools that have helped build community around this creativity. I'll give you one story of this community. A couple of years ago, Wired magazine released this Wired CD, which was a CD that had tracks by these artists, so the Beastie Boys, David Byrne, Gilberto Gil, La Tigra, Danger Mouse, a whole bunch of people who released their tracks under a license that allowed people to sample or remix the work, didn't allow them to distribute the work, the underlying work, that song was the artist, but encouraged people to build on these tracks. We then create this site called Mixtr. And what Mixtr does is enable people to see how their creative work has been remixed by others. So here's one of the songs by the Beastie Boys, which you can see is an ability to rate the song. And then you can see who's used the song. So samples are used in. And then here's an example of somebody who has remixed the song. And this song, Board on Your Backside, has been used, samples these other songs listed below it. And you can see where this has actually been sampled by other artists. So the point is, by this technology, you can begin to see the community that's developing around people remixing other people's works, right? So this enables the recognition of a certain kind of artist. You can see my work is more remixed than everybody else within this community. And this project of Mixtr is being rolled out into a lot of different creative cultures. So we run contests about this regular using new music regularly. So Linkin Park was the latest of the contexts that we ran with Warner Records to make this work accessible in a way that people could remix it. But increasingly we're thinking about deploying in the context of schools. So imagine an LA school and a New York school that were within a community. And at the beginning of the term, each laid down tracks and invited other people to remix it. And then over the course of the term, kids from each of these schools would be remixing the music of the other, and by the end of a term or end of a year, you could begin to see the kind of creative, collaborative work that had happened. And each kid would be participating and also seeing as his or her work was being used and extended by others. That's the objective of this particular site. And it's also had the effect of creating successful artists. This is my favorite example of this. This guy named Minus Kelvin, as you might guess, is a high school physics teacher. He had a very distinctive form of composition, and you can see what he's looking for here was a record label. So he launched his membership in February of 2005. In June, he was signed by a record label who discovered him in CC Mixter and has discovered a bunch of artists in CC Mixter who they've now signed, because this is a context within which these artists can demonstrate their talent and make that talent accessible to a wide range of people. Now, the consequence, in my view, of what this activity, Creative Commons, is doing is to feed civic media. Because as a wide range of this content is accessible, then what it does is encourage people to use and reuse this content consistent with what the underlying artist had originally chosen. And that's the insight that really excited me about being able to come here and talk to you about how this idea might relate to the work of Pacifica. I take it as given here that Pacifica supports the idea of civic media. This is your history, and this is, I take it, the objective you're focusing on now. The challenge is to do it consistent with the values of public radio and also the business model of public radio, which is obviously a business model that depends upon public support for continued existence. So the test of public support is a test of your success in connecting to the civic values of the communities you operate in. So here's one idea to build upon this infrastructure that I've described in a way that might help Pacifica achieve this objective. And the idea is basically to think about content that is licensed in two ways simultaneously, dual licensed content. So imagine content licensed under a non-commercial license, meaning people were free to use that license, that content, in non-commercial ways without worrying about clearing any rights, because those rights have already been cleared by the license. But then there's a backup commercial license that limits or defines exactly how the work can be used commercially, and that commercial license is specified by Pacifica. So I showed you before our commons deed, which specifies the rights associated with, the freedoms associated with this particular content. Imagine this modified in a slight way. So the commons deed specifies the freedoms associated with the content, but then at the bottom you have the opportunity to click through to learn about commercial licensing opportunities you have with this content. And when you click there, you don't go to a Creative Commons site, but you go to something associated with Pacifica Radio, right? So you would specify the commercial terms that are linked to this CC content. So creating, in this sense, pod-friendly content or civic content, and all of that content would require giving attribution back to Pacifica. So one term in every one of our licenses is that attribution to the source is required. But by requiring attribution back to Pacifica, you increasingly build the recognition around the service and resource that Pacifica is making available into this community of new creators. Now, why would you want to do this? I think the answer is obvious to this, but my view is it's to identify civic media, to identify this as an ideal within democracy, that we encourage this activity of people creating and sharing ideas and culture and critique. Right? So you identify civic media and you support it. And you support it in a way consistent with at least my view of what public radio's role has been here, to support it relative to the other form of culture that gets put out there before us, commercial culture, or commercial radio in this particular way. And by setting up a distinct kind of creativity and activity, civic media, my view is you build a kind of loyalty in this growing community of creators who depend upon the opportunity to engage in this creativity and would really appreciate the opportunity to engage in this creativity without fearing the legal consequences of crossing an extraordinarily complicated set of rules that copyright law is. And then there's one final reason I want to push this idea here. So, you know, we're in the middle of a war, actually many wars. I want to talk about the copyright wars. Copyright wars, which my friend Jack Valenti, the former head of the Motion Picture Association of America, calls his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. Right? Now, this mentality, this war rhetoric, leads to the discussion of new weapons we can develop, both law and technology, designed to eliminate piracy. And that's the mentality that DC has about this issue of cultural creativity. Now, all of that war rhetoric exists oblivious to the consequence it increasingly has for our kids. That consequence is to produce a kind of extremism in our kids when our kids think about this set of regulation called copyright and a whole bunch of other regulations. I want to give you one particular example of how that extremism gets manifested by this brace of commercials.
Hi, I'm one of the kids who was prosecuted for downloading music free off of the internet. And I'm here to announce in front of everyone, we're still going to download music free off of the internet.
I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the...
And there's not a thing anyone can do about it.
So you can imagine how the ad execs at Pepsi and Apple were so proud of themselves that they captured the spirit of the times, which is that kids want to be able to download music free while drinking Pepsis, right? And you could actually worry a little bit about the health consequences there. I mean, they're going to have to drink a lot of Pepsi to get free music. And but the point is, within a week, that ad inspired this counter ad that was out on the internet. So the point is that this one kind of extremism produces this other kind of extremism. And in my view, both of these extremes are wrong. Both of these extremisms are harmful. But this excess of control that's being driven by this political rhetoric around the, quote, wars we wage drives this extremism on both sides. And it increasingly drives a kind of alienation and erosion of values that are important in our kids. So my former colleague, Charlie Nesson, who teaches at Harvard, teaches ethics at Harvard, describes the extremely difficult task of standing before his students and trying to explain to his students the ideas of legal ethics. So we have to explain to his students the ideas that when, for example, you come across evidence that you're under an obligation to reveal to the other side, you must turn it over to enable the process to function. And the kid's response to this is, why would I ever do that? Right? Because these kids are raised in a context where, in a wide range of cases, all they do is disobey the law. That's what they do. That's how they live. Like, the law tells them one thing, they ignore it because they think it's ridiculous. And increasingly in the context especially of culture. Right? They'll have sort of relations that most of our kids think are just ridiculous. And so as they live their life constantly against the law, the very idea of the rule of law is eroded. And this idea that in the context of a democracy, rather than fixing the law to reflect what people actually think, we instead raise a generation of kids to internalize the idea that the law is to be ignored, that is, in my view, the most significant cost from this, quote, war. Much more important than the profits of any particular industry. It is about the very basis of what a democracy is. And this is why it's urgent, in my view, that we find a way to resist this extremism, to begin to set a space for people to be creative, where they can internalize the idea that they are creative consistent with rules about how they're supposed to behave, a kind of sanity in this space. And that, in the end, is what I view the most important contribution that civic media can make. It is a space of creative critique that embraces not the idea of violating the law, but instead embraces the idea of building upon creativity of other consistent with the law for whatever end they seek. Right? This is the kind of balance that we have to create. In my view, Pacifica has an extremely important role to play here. You can be a leader in setting this distinct form of expression and identify it as distinct. And I'm eager to do whatever I can to help bring about that and answer whatever questions you have. Thank you very much for your time.